Welcome to The Med Thread, your monthly dose of all things drugs.
I'm Kathy.
And I'm Mike, and today we talk biological drugs, how we got here, and where it's going in the future. We'll touch on why it costs a fortune to make, a fortune to buy, and how we're trying to make it cheaper. The whole process, from before the prescription, to the pharmacy, and to our patients.
When I think of biologics, I think of Humira and Remicade, which I've dispensed a fair bit for arthritis and Crohn's, and then also Lantus for diabetes, and these are just a few examples. This class of drugs has definitely expanded since I graduated in 2011, and I'm glad to have an expert here to help me wrap my head around these drugs.
We speak of biologics as new things, but we've been using biologics since the beginning of medicine. Health Canada describes a biologic drug as a drug that comes from living organisms or their cells.
Essentially, almost all drugs prior to modern chemistry were isolated or made from plants and animals. With the advent of pharmaceutical chemistry, we had an explosion of using small chemical compounds made in the lab to treat disease. Now I imagine we're revisiting biology in a more wholesome way.
So a bit of background. Within Schedule D of the Food and Drugs Act are the biological drugs. They include a number of items, such as blood-derived factors, or the stuff you find in blood. And if you recall our second episode, when we chatted about anemia, blood transfusions were perhaps the earliest example of what we consider biological drugs. Giving blood from one animal or person to another could be life-saving.
Next on the list are vaccines. Ingrafting, or scratching little bits of crusted pustules of smallpox-infected individuals into healthy people, was seen to be effective in protecting them from the virus in the future. Taken from earlier practices in Eastern medicine, Western medicine started this in the early 1700s. They called it variolation, from the Latin name for smallpox, variola.
But it wasn't until the end of the 1700s, 1796 to be exact, when Edward Jenner took bits of cowpox lesions from a milkmaid and inoculated an 8-year-old boy. The milkmaids knew that if they had cowpox, they would not get smallpox. Jenner then inoculated the boy with cowpox, and behold, no problems. He named what he did vaccine, from vacca, meaning cow, and he called the smallpox material virus, directly from Latin virus, meaning poison.
And we've been giving vaccines ever since.
Not many from cows anymore.
Fast forward 100 years later, to the roaring 20s, we see the discovery of insulin, and diabetics now had a life-saving drug. This was isolated from cows and pigs for a long time. We had to wait until the 1970s and 80s before a recombinant human insulin, brand name Humulin, could be produced in bacteria. We consider this the first protein-based biologic drug. In simple terms, the recombinant DNA technology allowed scientists to produce the human gene for insulin and insert that into E. coli bacteria DNA. As the bacteria grow and reproduce, they also make insulin, which is then purified and extracted. How they get this done on an industrial scale is fascinating.
A few years after Humulin, a drug called Digibind was produced. It was the first antibody approved by the FDA. Digibind was, and the current version, called Digifab, is still made by sheep.
Sheep are immunized with an analog of digoxin and produce these antibodies, which are then extracted from their blood. As an antibody that binds specifically to the drug digoxin, it was able to eliminate digoxin from the body in the case of an overdose. Now we could begin to take full advantage of the specificity of antibodies to their targets, and many, many lives were saved and continue to be saved.
So there are clear regulations and a clear history of these older biologic drugs. But today we move away from farm animals and talk about new classes of biologics, such as the monoclonal antibodies.
One major difference between biologic drugs and your ibuprofen is the molecular size of the drug. Where ibuprofen has 33 atoms in it, a monoclonal antibody has well over 10,000 or even 20,000 atoms.
So you can't really make them through a chemical reaction. And unlike insulin, which we could take from animal sources, what we need to do with these new drugs is grow them.
We knew about antibodies from immunology, and we developed a way to hijack mice biology to make them for us. I promise that's the last animal sound effect. By exposing the mice to a particular antigen or protein we wanted to target, their immune system would produce a response and create these antibodies.
And you might be thinking, each mouse is different, so wouldn't each antibody be different too? And there are definitely not enough mice in the world to make enough. And you'd be absolutely right. We need something else to continue making them. And this is where it gets complicated. When making monoclonal antibodies, we call them monoclonal because they come from the same cell. But what cell?
What cell lives really long and is essentially the same all the time? What about cancer cells? We can take those antibodies produced by mice and induce cancer cells to continuously make lots and lots of these antibodies for us. Now, if you just use the mouse antibodies, humans would mount immune responses to those similar to an allergic reaction. We also need to make sure that our bodies don't label the drug as foreign compounds and attack them. Part of the process is to humanize the antibody, so it is more than 95% human.
Overall, the process varies widely and quite oversimplified in our explanation, especially when it comes to producing these industrially. But the concept of using natural biology to produce drugs remains similar. An article last year in The Conversation describes, in easily understood language, how biologics are different than conventional pharmaceuticals. I'll post the link on our webpage.
This brings us to, what exactly are these biologics used for? Are we on the cusp of really personal medicine? To find some answers, we're lucky to have Sheldon Baines in studio with us. He's a pharmacist working at BioScript Pharmacy, which specializes in delivering patient care in relation to these biologic drugs, among other things. We're going to pick his brain for the therapeutic and practical knowledge he has. Hey Sheldon, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's start off just talking a little bit about BioScript. So how is BioScript different from your traditional community pharmacy?
Well, when I usually introduce BioScript, I usually start with the name itself. We call ourselves BioScript to emphasize the fact that we focus on biologic prescriptions. BioScript, biologic prescriptions smashed together to make the names. So the biologics, a lot of the high-end injection medications, infusion medications. Unlike a regular community pharmacy, I guess we're not filling hundreds of high blood pressure medications or antibiotics, anything like that, during the run of a day. All day, every day, we focus on these specialty products, which I guess allows us to become a little bit more familiar, not just with the medications and the conditions that they're used to treat, but with any number of the other wrinkles that could potentially go along with these therapies as well.
And it's really cool because I think, you know, these drugs have certainly taken off over the last couple of years, and you think of pharmacy like BioScript wouldn't have really existed years ago. So it's cool that there's now a specific pharmacy or specialist area in this biologic prescriptions. And I guess, what do you see biologics used for most here in Newfoundland? And I guess, how does that compare to the rest of the country? Where do we stack up?
Well, they're used in a lot of areas, to be sure. Certainly here in Newfoundland in particular, but all across the country, we see a lot of autoimmune conditions. So things like multiple sclerosis, inflammatory bowel disease, including Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, rheumatological conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, dermatological conditions like psoriasis, hidradenitis suppurativa, or various combinations of those like psoriatic arthritis or enteropathic arthritis, etc. Many of these conditions seem to have a genetic component, and in Newfoundland, we seem to have a more prominent predisposition compared to many other jurisdictions across the country or around the world. They are certainly used in many other areas, like oncology, as you've mentioned, but they're also expanding into new treatment areas, such as migraine.
So certainly not just for one condition, a whole long list of conditions.
So, Sheldon, how effective are these medications over the other options and compared to each other?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I hear many of the medications that we deal with on a daily basis referred to as miracle drugs all of the time. So many clients essentially report that they feel like they've been given their lives back or that they have a new lease on life. And certainly it's very rewarding to be at least some small part of that. Many of these patients, unfortunately, have languished for years, potentially taking less effective treatments, either due to delays in getting to see a specialist for proper assessment and treatment, or in the marathon of hurdles they sometimes have to jump over to meet the criteria to qualify for coverage of some of these more expensive therapies. many of them are at the end of their ropes or forgot what it was like to lead a quote-unquote normal life, or gave up hope that getting back there was ever possible again. And then when they're finally given the opportunity to be on one of these life-altering treatments, it can be a very emotional experience, to say the least. I had a gentleman that I did an injection training session for just over a month ago who had very severe psoriasis, essentially covering his entire body. His hands were some of the worst that I've ever seen, and it was nearly as bad on his face, with one of his eyes essentially being forced shut. Not only was it physically torturous for him to deal with the pain and the itch and the inability to sleep or to get comfortable, but to walk down the street and perceive that people are constantly giving you that, oh my goodness, is that contagious look, takes a severe emotional toll on a lot of clients as well. He came back for his second dose just last week, and I could hardly believe that it was the same person. And he could barely contain his appreciation for having started the therapy. He went from being absolutely covered to essentially being almost 100% clear just after one dose and in a four-week span. But what really struck me was to hear him describe how he can walk down the street now and people don't stare at him anymore. I put in a couple of pictures there just for reference. I wouldn't have believed it if I didn't document it. I had to take a picture before I did the injection training because I was like, oh my gosh, I have to see if he's going to be one of these people that get the miraculous benefit. And when he came back, he actually hid his hands in his pocket. And you could see he was almost giddy. And when I went to shake his hand, he took his hand out. It was emotional for me because it was so emotional for him.
Yes, that's really amazing. I'm just looking at the pictures here, and what a huge difference that has made.
And we're exposed to similar stories to that every day, whether it be for clients that have Crohn's disease and have felt like a prisoner in their own home out of fear to venture outside and not be in an immediate proximity to a bathroom, or horror stories of clients that refuse to stay home and then had the unbelievably embarrassing incident where they've tried to, you know, to request to use a bathroom in a business only to be refused and unfortunately unable to hold it. Or for an RA patient that's forgot what it was like not to have ever-present debilitating pain. Some of them describe going from essentially being relegated to a wheelchair to jumping up and down in their bed like a child when their bodies no longer betray them. The list goes on and on. When the condition is suitably controlled, the impact quite often goes well beyond the physical.
So when it comes to risk, we certainly have to talk about the safety of these drugs. And I understand it's a generalized statement, but I get the question a lot. How do they affect the immune system?
Well, I'm glad to say that for most of the biologics that we deal with, most people don't experience any downside at all. Certainly, a lot of people get freaked out at the thought of getting a needle or getting an infusion. They automatically assume that it must be serious or dangerous or something like that, but ultimately, it's just another way to get a medication into the body. Many of these drugs do target the immune systems, and that's because many of the issues in the target conditions are a result of an overactive immune system that for whatever reason has gotten turned on and forgot how to shut off, and thus continually spew out extra inflammatory cytokines that can wreak havoc on our own healthy cells. I stole a sink analogy from a specialist in town a couple of years ago that I find a lot of patients can kind of, you know, make it real for them, I suppose. So if you think of your immune system like a sink, normally if you want to wash the dishes, you turn on the tap, you run so much water in the sink, you wash the dishes, you turn off the tap, and away you go. And you can kind of think of that's sort of how our immune system would typically work. We're exposed to a bug, a virus, bacteria. Our immune system gets activated. We generate these inflammatory cytokines, deal with the infectious pathogen, if you will. Once we deal with it, we kind of, you know, our immune system kind of goes back into a resting mode, and away we go. But in one of these autoimmune conditions in particular, the immune system's gotten turned on. So this tap has gotten turned on. But unfortunately, we don't know how to shut it off anymore. So eventually, the sink not only fills up with water, but the extra water starts to pour over onto the floor, and You know, you got a flooded kitchen now and you're getting rot around the floorboards and all this kind of stuff. And that's a similar idea. Your body is producing extra inflammatory cytokines that are now just flooding your whole body, and where they kind of hang out and wreak their havoc kind of determines what the condition is. So if it's in your joints, rheumatoid arthritis. If it's in your spine, ankylosing spondylitis, gastrointestinal tract, Crohn's and colitis, and so on and so forth. And you can kind of think of these medications like mops, if you will. So a lot of the medications bind up or soak up the extra inflammatory cytokine, but unlike a traditional pain pill, let's say, that you take and you might notice a benefit a half an hour later, if you think about one of these medications, it can quite often take a lot longer than that for you to really start noticing the benefit. And the way I describe that to clients is, well, right now your kitchen is probably flooded before they start therapy. So coming in with one mop is probably not going to be enough to get it cleaned up. So quite often these medications have an induction period where they get either more medication or more doses closer together. So I say we're coming in with more mops early on to try and get the floor clean. And then once we get the floor clean, we'll come back on our regular interval, be it monthly or every 2 months, what have you, and try and keep the floor clean. Because unfortunately, we still don't know how to turn off that tap. So there's always going to be that trickle right onto the floor. So we have to come back regularly and make sure that we're doing that touch-up work as well.
And I hope you don't mind, but I'm probably going to end up stealing that sink analogy as well when I'm trying to explain patients how these things work. And, you know, it's definitely a new process for patients. You know, it's a specialty pharmacy that involves infusions and needles, and there may be a fear about, you know, the injection side of things, but also the whole process and then the fear of any potential side effects in this. So how do you help patients through this whole kind of new experience and new process?
Well, we take a lot of time up front to make sure that clients are well informed, comfortable, and hopefully excited with the proposed treatment plan. An objective weighing of the risks versus benefits of most of these medications would typically make the choice clear, but ultimately the client decides what goes into their body and they need to be comfortable with that prospect. Many of them have suffered for long enough that they're willing to try just about anything, but there's others that have heard someone say that a friend read something online that, you know, they'd never put any of that kind of stuff in their body. Rationally addressing those apprehensions can be challenging and time-consuming, but I think well worth the extra investment up front to help them get off on the right foot.
I can certainly appreciate that you guys are out there and that you offer this service for these patients, and I'm sure your patients appreciate it too. So what do pharmacies actually do when it comes to biologics?
Certainly we try and help iron out any number of wrinkles that could cause clients to get tripped up and fail to realize the full benefit of these incredible products. And unfortunately, a lot of these wrinkles have historically caused far too many patients to get suboptimal results. Quality control is a big responsibility, and one of BioScript's original claims to fame, as it were, was our commitment to quality assurance, being able to guarantee that these incredibly expensive, temperature-sensitive medications were always stored and handled under ideal conditions to be able to ensure that what gets into a client's body was at its absolute best and thus had the best chance of providing the maximum benefit. We've invested heavily in our refrigeration quality and capacity, as well as in constant monitoring and detailed multi-level alerts to make sure that the medications never are in jeopardy.
And where are we now in terms of the pharmacist's role?
I would suggest that nearly as, if not more important, is setting the client up for success by providing detailed counseling and support, coordinating with other healthcare professionals, helping navigate the reimbursement waters, tapping into copay support, etc., as well as training, if not physically administering these medications, and being there to serve as a trusted resource for the patients on their journey forward, helping to detect and or mitigate any potential issues that may arise, and hopefully ensure the best possible outcomes. Being there to help guide clients through the entire process and minimize the stresses that can go along with facing these new therapies, especially when you consider the cost involves being unimaginable for most. And stress can be a huge contributor to flares in many of the autoimmune conditions in particular that we're treating. So we try and shoulder as many of those hassles and stressors and help navigate the often daunting waters so that clients can focus on getting better.
And you've mentioned stressors, and you've also mentioned a little bit about the expense of these medications. So speaking of cost and coverage, let's talk about the dollars and cents of these medications. And I'm talking a lot more dollars than cents here.
How much does the typical biologic actually cost to the patient?
Thankfully, most of our clients have very little, if any, out-of-pocket costs associated with these therapies. As you're aware, though, the overall costs involved can be formidable. Can cost anywhere between $1 and $2 billion to bring one of these medications to market. And when you consider having to cover the R&D expense of not just this product, but the hundreds of other molecules that were being investigated but never did make it to market, the overhead that the pharmaceutical companies are shouldering is considerable. Thankfully for payers, Health Canada helps to regulate the price of most of these products, and I get the impression that most of them wind up being priced considering what the market deems reasonable to treat a particular condition over the course of a year. And then the cost per dose depends on how often you actually need to receive that treatment. It wouldn't be uncommon for a typical therapy to cost $20,000 or more per year, and we have some that cost that much or more per dose.
Wow, that's a lot of money, and I honestly don't think that people could pay for it. So the million-dollar question is, who pays for it?
Thankfully for patients, we are normally able to coordinate with private and or public payers and or patient support programs to help minimize, if not completely eliminate, any patient out-of-pocket cost. Even a small percent copay when it comes to some of these expensive medications could still be a huge financial burden for clients and an undue stressor when we've already noted that that can have therapeutic consequences. Financial barriers, though, are probably still the most common block to treatment access. But unfortunately, the cost associated with not suitably treating many of these conditions has to be considered as well. Not only are there significant impacts in terms of direct dollars and cents to the healthcare system, which is probably where the reasonable cost to treat a condition X in a given year comes from, that along with the societal cost, I guess, in terms of lost productivity and whatnot. But I would also suggest that it's hard to put a price on the new lease on life that many of these clients feel that they've been given when on one of these therapies as well. The prospect of continued suffering and disease progression versus the optimism and the hope for the future that often accompanies these therapies, many would say is priceless.
And you certainly mentioned the research and development side of things, and we know that medications do take a lot of money to develop. The Fraser Institute, a Canadian research group, issued a report in 2016 quoting $1.2 billion as pre-approval cost for biologics. The pharmaceutical industry quoted up to $2.6 billion. Overall, there are way too many variables to consider, with overestimates and underestimates from various groups. But either way, we're looking at numbers in the billion-dollar range and a decade of investment time.
And so trying to find a reliable estimate is nearly impossible, and probably very difficult to calculate. But overall, drug prices, like Sheldon mentioned, are not reflected by the manufacturing costs, but rather the argument of recuperating the research and development costs and to have capital to further fund new research. For medications that are widely used, this could mean lower costs. But for the biologics, which are arguably less used, pricing can be a challenge. And if they're treating life-threatening conditions like cancer, it becomes even more muddled. So how do we try to make these medications more affordable? One answer may be biosimilars.
Our talk wouldn't be complete without mentioning the biosimilars, which, similar to generic drugs, is to provide cost savings and be an equivalent alternative to the single brand product. But the problem is that biosimilars are not like your traditional generic drugs. It's produced by different cells or biotech processes. So, unlike a chemical, the antibody will be slightly different, but still quite structurally and molecularly similar between brands, hence the name.
Before we look at the cost of biosimilars, I think it's important to know briefly how drugs are priced in Canada. First, brand or patented drugs are priced through the Patented Medicine Prices Review Board, a federal body. However, as healthcare is generally part of provincial jurisdiction, drug prices were traditionally negotiated directly between companies and the provincial governments. To help drive uniformity and consistency, the Pan-Canadian Pharmaceutical Alliance, a joint initiative from the provincial and territorial governments, was formed to conduct national negotiations of drug prices.
In 2016, they issued the first principles for the subsequent entry biologics, which we've been calling the more familiar term biosimilars. Part of the principles are that biosimilars must offer cost savings relative to the reference biologic. But even though it is a fraction of the cost of a novel biologic, biosimilars can still cost hundreds of millions to develop. We can compare this to under a $10 million price tag to bring a generic drug to the market. This means that the overall cost savings of a biosimilar will be considerably lower than a generic. In fact, generic drugs can be priced at 25% or less of the brand equivalent, but for biosimilars, sometimes it may only be as low as 80%. But for a $10,000 per year drug, 80% is still $2,000 in savings.
In the approval process, generic drugs need to show that they achieve the same blood concentration levels in people compared to the brand. In contrast, biosimilars have to show some proof that they're safe and effective, or just as effective as the reference drug. This means that they need to conduct some more extensive clinical trials. But what happens when there are multiple indications for a drug, as we mentioned before? One major advantage of biosimilars is that they can use a concept called extrapolation to extend their use to additional indications. The government looks at the overall scientific evidence of their similarity and may approve them for expanded use. This means they don't need to conduct clinical trials for all the indications, which is a considerable cost saving.
The other factor to consider is clinician comfort with the evidence, or lack thereof, supporting the use of these alternatives. This is something that will continue to evolve, but currently, most clinicians aren't particularly comfortable with the thought of non-medical switching, meaning a patient being switched from one molecule to another for non-medical reasons, but for payer reasons or what have you. If someone is well established and maintained on a particular therapy, then you don't want to mess with it. If it ain't broke, then don't fix it, as the old saying goes. However, some payers will probably suggest that it is broken and potentially try and quote-unquote fix it. It's my life, it's now or never. I ain't gonna live forever. I just wanna live and I'm alive.
As the industry and our science develops and matures, hopefully we can make these medications more affordable to patients. If we can go from extracting insulin from animals to making it in cells 50 years later, the possibilities in the next 50 years are very promising.
I really wish we had more time to talk about these drugs. I feel we've barely scratched the surface. But know this, the history of biological drugs dates back to the 17th century. What we've learned to do is manipulate living biology through technology to create new medications for conditions that we were unable or ineffectively treating with pharmaceutical chemistry.
We'd definitely like to thank our guest from BioScript, Sheldon, for his insightful experiences. It's been a pleasure learning from you.
Oh no, thank you for the invite. It's been a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited actually that a podcast like the MedThread is on the go now. And if any of the listeners to this podcast hasn't checked out their previous ones, please do. I'll be subscribing to it going forward, to be sure.
Yes, thank you so much.
So as always, you can find our references and notes on our website at www.mtsclinic.ca. And if you have questions, comments, or things you just want to hear about, send us a message on Facebook via the School of Pharmacy or email medthread@mun.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathy.
And I'm Mike. Tune in next month when we get into the school year and talk about ADHD and stimulants.